We're ready as soon as everyone gets here.
There, I see everybody's here now.
Okay, so we're supposed to start with 5, 6, and 8.
How did you get here? Did you get that? Like from the...
Yeah.
What time did you get here?
8:25.
We were down there at
8:35.
We just left it at 35. And then nothing happened.
Yeah.
It takes longer. You can't do it in half an hour. Your night. I matched your night. Sound and room. I went for the workout.
I don't tell them they shouldn't use it again.
Well, it's also so far.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 30 plus minutes.
Yeah. Back and forth.
So, how do you want to do this? You want to chair all of these?
David, no.
I didn't even say about it.
You want me to do the first couple and then.
Yes, because that's yours.
He's like, yeah, we tried
and then you
were
okay
go
for the cardiac.
They
asked that we do them in this order.
Okay, because people want to leave.
How he needs to leave.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, I am.
I'm going to go take my guys and go look at that mammo center. I'm going to go look at age spread across the center.
So we go ahead?
Yeah. All right, I think everyone's here, so let's go ahead and get started for today. We're going to shuffle the order around a little bit just because to accommodate schedules and whatnot. So we're going to do in the following order the next three, 5, 6, and 8. We've already done 7. So Eric and I are going to split things up today. Okay. Okay, so while we're waiting for Dr. Raja to join us, we can probably go ahead and start with any other. Ian, you look like you have another announcement to make.
Yeah, I just want to make a quick announcement. For transcription purposes, you can really just make sure you do say your name and you do start to speak, and that, I guess, talk loudly. I know some individuals are having a hard time hearing in certain areas of the room, as well as try to keep down some of the side conversations because the microphones are picking up all the different conversations, and I think it's very difficult for those individuals listening online as well as for transcription purposes. Those are just two things to keep in mind.
Okay. And then as we start with number 5, which is appropriate pulmonary CT imaging of pulmonary embolism, a lot of the discussion about the feasibility, I think, is going to be similar to tomorrow. So we could probably we can probably recall that discussion and have an abbreviated version of it if we need to today in the interest of keeping moving.
And actually, just one more point of clarification that Ian mentioned to you this morning that we should have been more clear about yesterday. As we look at those criteria, importance to measure and report is now a must-pass criterion. So if a measure isn't passing on importance, we don't need to actually do the rest of the
okay.
Keep that in mind. If it's like a measure. Most of the ones yesterday made it on importance.
But making it on importance, meaning it has to be all high or has to be high in middle?
It's basically the pass say not low.
Okay. So the majority of people are not giving it a low. Great. Okay. All right. So let's start with number 5. Gavin, are you the primary reviewer?
No, I am.
Okay.
Number 5 is appropriate pulmonary CT imaging for pulmonary embolism. This is from the group at Brigham. And the conditions for consideration have been met. Under D, however, the testing will be completed within 24 months. Was there an obligation to have that done in 12 months?
We've just changed our policy.
Okay.
But we'll work with whoever that is.
Okay. But I did notice that.
Yeah, before we go,
give us a big picture of the description of the measure, the nominator, numerator, and denominator, and then go through your evaluation, if you could, please.
Sure. The issue, quite honestly, is overuse of CTPA, or what some people call CTPE, CT angiogram to rule out pulmonary embolism, which essentially has displaced EQ scans almost universally. And the concern is now that it's so easy to order, and the results are much less ambiguous than VQ scans used to be, so people order them willy-nilly. And in terms of the numerator, we're looking at people that fulfill certain, I think, relatively reasonable criteria for being at risk for PE, and the denominator is all CT PEs that are done. This is for a single patient visit, so time is really not an issue. In terms of the, give you what you want?
Yeah, well, I can just so everyone knows, the numerator is high clinical probability of PE, lower intermediate clinical probability, and a positive high sensitivity D dimer, low probability and a positive non-high sensitivity D dimer, or an intermediate clinical probability and no availability of high sensitivity.
I was going to go into that detail, actually. Okay. I covered that. Thank you.
Just because I think not everyone has read them recently, it's good to go through the specific details.
So in terms of the importance and the measure to report, this is a relatively common entity that we treat in emergency medicine with some estimates that from 1 in 500 to 1 in 1,000 patients that present with PED presenting with pulmonary embolus. In terms of the 1A criteria, I gave it a C. I think they do address that. In terms of 1B, the opportunity for improvement, that is, this is something that I think is documented in the literature, but also something that we talk with most people in teaching programs, something that we struggle with on a daily basis in terms of inappropriate ordering of diagnostic studies. And they give several citations concerning the performance gap. I gave that a C. 1C, the outcome or evidence to support the measure focus. This is a lot of this deals with a guideline that was actually from the European literature, although it's felt that this, most of it, in fact, would apply to American practice as well, and there's been some discussion of that in the literature as well. This builds on several other protocols in terms of evaluation of patients that may be at risk for PE in terms of trying to segment them into between high, intermediate, or low risk. So given that, I gave 1C a C as well. So in terms of overall for one, I gave it a yes with the rationale that it is an overused study and sometimes an improperly used study. So there is certainly a room for improvement. In terms of two, the measure specifications, 2A, again, the numerator is the number of patients who are also in the denominator who have a documented indication consistent with guidelines prior to CT imaging. And what they have done, there's several, again, this is based mainly on the European guideline, which gathers a lot of other studies together. And as was mentioned by Scott, it's a high clinical probability of PE, a low or intermediate clinical probability of PE, and a positive high-sensitive D-dimer. The third is a low clinical probability and a positive non-high-sensitivity D-dimer. As an aside, the D-dimer, which is a clinical lab test used to segment the population. They come in two flavors, the high sensitivity and the low sensitivity, which should really be discarded. I don't know if any place uses low sensitivity anymore. It's just a troublemaker. But they had to deal with that, so that's why you see reference to both high and non-high sensitivity D-dimers. And then the fourth is an intermediate clinical probability and no availability of high sensitivity D-dimer. In terms of the classification of high or low or intermediate, there are several algorithms that can be used. There's Wells criteria, there's modified Wells, there's the Geneva criteria, modified Geneva, simplified Geneva, and these are relatively well known. Yeah, obviously there's not a lot of universality in terms of the agreement here to emergency physicians, but there is a safety hatch here, and this says clinical probability can be determined by a structured prediction tool or implicit judgments. And I draw attention to that because I think that's very important. So if someone says, you know, I don't do all that stuff, but I think that this patient has a high probability of PD, that in fact would be reasonable justification to do the study. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing because it's very hard, I think, with studies with protocols such as this to forecast 100% certainty. I mean, we are imperfect, so this gives, I think, a reasonable outlet for that. In terms of the target population, it's adult patients age 18 or greater. They do have exclusions for unstable patients, which, again, is quite reasonable. If you have a patient that comes in hypotensive with sudden onset of chest pain after an 8-hour airplane flight, you don't need you don't need to go through an algorithm. You need to get studied. So those people are excluded. And the data source collection, the data will be from the medical record. They make the statement that these can be easily recorded either electronically or on paper. Again, as was brought up, mentioned by Scott beforehand, this suffers from many of the same shortcomings that we discussed in great detail yesterday. So that is certainly an issue for here as well. I gave it a P of partial for the measure specification, again, because of the data source limitations. The 2B reliability testing, I gave that a C because of the number of studies that we've over the years have dealt with in terms of CTPA. The validity testing, I gave it a P because they have ongoing validity testing now. We've already addressed the 24-month issue. The exclusions, again, we talked about the shock and the hypotension as being exclusions. So I gave that a C. Risk adjustment not necessary, gave that an NA. Identification 2F, identification of meaningful differences in performance, they really don't address that, so I gave that an N. Comparability of multiple data sources, that's an NA. Disparities is an NA. And I gave it a P because the validity testing is ongoing. Usability, I think I gave that a P. It will be appropriate for public reporting. 3B, that's NA, the relation to other NQF endorsed measures. There are some venous thromboembolism measures, but again, they really are more complementary than anything else. Harmonization is an NA. Distinctive or additive value is an NA. Again, overall, I gave that a P. for the entire area. Feasibility for A is a P, how the data elements that are used to be measures score is generated. And again, overall, for B, I gave an M, minimal, because of all the issues we discussed yesterday in terms of extracting this data. The same is true for the 4C, the exclusions. Susceptibilities and inaccuracies, errors, or unintended consequences, I think they do address that. I gave that a C. And data collection strategy implementation, I gave that a P. And overall, I gave this an M because I think it's still, for the reasons we discussed yesterday, it is a significant issue.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Are there other comments from the review group?
Gavin Stetson and actually Rich, we had little bucket conferences and discussed some of the different protocols that we were reviewing and have no additional comments.
Okay. I have a couple of things I'd like to add, though. Just a few issues I think bear discussion. And one of those is... In trying to, this is certainly a problematic area. I think it's an important area. I think there's opportunity for improvement. I think that the data, as I understand it, demonstrates that implicit judgment on the part of the physician is equivalent for intermediate and high probability patients when you look at the PIOPED study, PIOPED 2 study. Structure the review. Certainly helpful, particularly in the low probability patients. I have a little pause with respect to the intermediate probability patients here in putting those patients in the numerator with positive D-dimer just because of the concern that I don't know that there's a preponderance of evidence showing that, or a big volume of evidence, showing that there's a big margin of safety for those patients. So if the prevalence of the disease in that group is in the range of 13% or so, and the negative likelihood ratio is 0.13, then you're kind of pushing up against the edge of where you want to be in terms of getting down to a number of patients you would miss. So I believe that you want to get down below 2% because the risk of testing starts to introduce risks of contrast to property and other issues. And technically, a number of studies, and I know the European recommendations are that you can do this. And so the science is there to demonstrate that you can use D-dimer in the intermediate group. But I feel that for quality measures, the science should be black and white with a lot of data supporting it.
Richard, I'm sorry, this is Rebecca Smith-Byman. Are you saying that the sensitivity of this algorithm is not high enough that they're going to miss some PEs in this group of patients?
Yes. But that's my concern.
Do you have any idea, I don't know this literature very well, what kind of ballpark we might be expecting to miss these? What does the literature using their algorithm suggest?
Well, I think that if you're saying like 1%.
So that the prevalence in the negative group could be as high as 1% of PEs, or that... So in patients who don't fit this algorithm, who don't need CT based on this algorithm, would that group of patients have 1% PEs? Or?
Well, I think that in the group of patients who are risk stratified by the tools to fall into an intermediate probability for PE, the prevalence of PE in that group can be as high as. So
this is Scott Gazelle. Even with a, what we're concerned about that group, I think, with an and a negative D dimer. What's the prevalence of PE in?
Yes, so that so then not with so after, yeah. After you have a negative D dimer, that drops significantly, right? So I mean the and the negative predictive value of I'm sorry, the negative likelihood ratio is very good. And so it will drop you down below the threshold to 2%. Where, yeah, down below 2%, so that people feel better about that, about using that. And I guess my concern is, well, how strong, I mean, I want...
2% is pretty high.
Yeah. Well, it, but I think the counter-argument, I believe, is that testing with PECT starts to introduce its own problems, and so 2% may be a reasonable threshold. I would just like to see that number as low as possible, and I think that that while I feel good about it in the low-risk group, I just want to voice a little hesitation there, and I'd like to see very clear numbers before we make that quality measure.
So, Scott, get that again. So what you would propose is high or intermediate does not require a positive D-dimer. Is that what you're proposing?
Yes. I'm saying that low requires
it. Low requires, yes, a D-dimer, high and intermediate, clinical judgment alone. You wouldn't require structured Wells or Geneva or anything? Just
No. I mean, well, in this measure, it recommends that you use structure.
But it doesn't require
it. It doesn't require it. But it recommends it, and I think kind of along the lines of the discussion we had yesterday with respect to the head CT, I think there's going to be this Hawthorne effect, and I think that this is going to encourage use of a structured approach. And there will probably be spillover into the intermediate range, but I just think that why not start conservatively? I think you'll achieve the same thing by starting with just the low prob group instead of putting both of them in there. And that's just my personal thought.
I would support Dr. Griffey's assessment. And also, I would wonder if there's a way to potentially simplify the numerator. It's very complex. And I understand the problem. I mean, sometimes clinical medicine isn't simple. But by the same token, if there be any way to streamline this, because I've got four very different conditions that I have to think about individually, and I just think we want, in terms of, this goes to, from my point of view, usability, teachability, that if we can maybe make it easier, it might be something that we have a better compliance
with. So,
Dr. Raja was joining us on
okay.
the phone if you want to direct any of those questions.
Are you on the phone, Dr. Raja? Not yet. So what would you think about instead of high is better, if we just used as a numerator the patients with a low clinical probability and a negative D-dimer, and then you're trying to minimize that? That would get
yeah,
to
if you
your
had
point.
A negative high sensitivity D-dimer.
And those that get a CTPA.
Right.
Yeah.
So then what you want is the lowest number of that.
Yes.
Could you repeat that again?
So it seems that the discussion has said that what they're really interested in is identifying patients who have a low clinical probability and a negative D-dimer that we shouldn't be doing, should not be doing. So making, yeah, making an overuse measure.
I would say a negative high sensitivity.
Negative high sensitivity.
Right, and that's going to be the catch.
Oh, here we are.
We're not actually sure how many places are actually using the high sensitivity D-dimer. We are, and places that we've surveyed are. But if we can find out whether or not people are using the high sensitivity D-dimer and it's negative, and their low probability, I think that's great to use it as an overuse measure as well. If that's the intent, is to measure overuse.
And that would, Scott Gazelle again here, that would simplify the measure and address the concerns that the review group has raised. Ray.
Ray Gibbons, I just want to point out a potential problem with that as I listen, which is if I don't measure the D-dimer and now I just have a low probability and I do a CTPA, that person will not be in the measure as overuse.
Right. And so that was obviously, as you guys have already gone over, the initial reason why we wanted to actually review all CT scans for pulmonary embolus and then figure out which ones met these criteria was that if you actually did look at all CT scans done for pulmonary embolus and then went through and looked at whether or not they did measure a D-dimer and or had low clinical criteria, you would actually catch them.
So the modification could be that the numerator is patients with a low clinical probability and either no D-dimer or no high sensitive D-dimer or a negative high
sensitive. Or a negative D-dimer, right.
And that, would that be acceptable from the measure developer standpoint?
It would be. It would. I think it would give us the same outcome, which is exactly the overuse that we want to measure.
It would probably be helpful if they actually give us some data back before you make a final decision.
Absolutely.
Or can be like condition, have them respond with some data.
Exactly.
Give us a sense of how different it's
like that. Howard and then Howie, sorry, and then Don.
Are we able to make certain that the D-dimer is actually ordered and viewed before the study?
So you would say that the D-dimer has to have been at the time the CT was performed at least, because you could have ordered it and then canceled
it. You'd like it in the order though, just because it'd be hard to verify it otherwise.
But the Steve Gambro, clinically, I'm not worried about that because it behooves them to have the results back before they go to CT. If I get the results back after CT, I'm screwed. I'm screwing myself.
Yeah, how long is the D-dimer then?
So I'm
how fast do you get labs back?
Well, if I'm going to order the lab for a reason, I wait for that result. I don't just send off labs.
All right, Don.
I like the measure.
Don Rucker.
Sorry, I like the measure. I guess the challenge I think clinically though is actually on the positive D dimers. You know, we get D dimers on lots and lots of people now, and unfortunately they are often positive for reasons that are I think just plain ill defined. And so then we're sort of boxed into doing the CT. And that's where I think the big misuse and overuse is on these low pretest probability D-dimers that are positive. That's, I think, where the big spend is.
But if you don't want to act on the study, then don't send the study.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the it other thing is...
It doesn't say you have to scan them.
No. Right. It doesn't say you have to scan them. It just allows you to scan them.
Troy, all right. It's the real world in the hospitals I've worked in. Every time the D-dimer is positive, a CT angiogram is ordered. And I've dealt with this on rounds of our residents multiple times, doing research on the false positive rate, and we end up scanning a whole lot of people.
Richard Grimble. I mean, that's a separate quality measure. Don't send a D-dimer in patients who don't need one. And the other caveat, and I don't want to complicate things, but you know there are other rules like the PERC rule that will essentially identify the patients who you already have identified as low risk to make them very low risk to the point where you don't even need to see send a D-dimer. And those patients wouldn't fall into the denominator because not only would you not get the study, you wouldn't get the D-dimer or the study. I guess that's not really a...
Absolutely. It's a great point, but I think it's a little bit outside the purview of this quality measure.
Carl and then Mike. Carl Dorsey. Once you... This is an overuse measure. So once you get that number, what's ideal to you? 2%, 4%? Zero is ideal, but what would you accept?
I don't think we need to specify a threshold for an overuse measure. Is that correct?
Okay, so 50% doesn't make any difference.
No, it would just be public reporting.
Okay, fine. So this has got no
other sort of aggressive mean.
Mike.
So I have two questions. Yesterday we talked about CT of the head for you know the non-significant trauma or non-penetrating trauma, and we talked about a potential improvement of 30%+ in an organization via the measure. Do we have any sense as to what the potential improvement would be here? I mean, if you take out you know essentially the highs and the moderates and all that. And I guess I'd couple that with the summary of evidence of high impact where it says you know, about 1.5% of the patients in the ER get a CTPA, and I'm wondering if you take that down to the, if I think about an ER doing 50,000 visits a year, you know, that's 750 or two a day, if you take out the medium or the moderate and high probabilities, I don't know if that whacks out half of it. Am I essentially looking at kind of one study in the ER a day? And then I just wonder if we're in the significance. I don't know the incident. You know, based on what they say here, 1.5, I think of people showing up in the ER because they hit their head is way more common than low indication of PE.
Perhaps we could ask the measure developer if you had, even from your own institution, some information on the number of low clinical probability negative D-dimer patients that are undergoing CTPA.
That's a good question, and that study is actually going on right as we speak. We don't have any preliminary data. I'm sorry. It's been about 2 months, but we will have data for you very soon.
Okay.
I will just end, I'm sorry. Just anecdotally, one thing that he's concerned about going forward, and a lot of sense is already aware of this, is the whole triple rule out study, which is effectively a non-D-dimer, low-risk patient who has chest pain, and radiology now has the capacity in about 90 seconds to do a CT thoracic aortogram, a CT coronary angiogram, and a CT pulmonary embolus study. All at once, 90 seconds, it only costs about the same price as a Jaguar.
And the patients are 22.
Yeah, no, but it's true. And I'll tell you, that is, if anything, if you want to do any reason at all, this is a good measure for that, because these are all theoretically low risk for PE. They're definitely high risk for other things.
So triple rule-outs in that setting would count in the numerator of this measure, then?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That we would need to specify that specifically. I mean, because there are other means you could game this in a way. If you were going to get a dissection protocol, CT, rather than PET-CT, I mean, most places will protocol those differently, and so you have to pick between them. But there is this triple rule out that will.
And this is like a trend that's just Howie Forman, that is just taking off, and it's frightening to me because it just seems like the floodgates can be open in no time.
Kirk's, right? No, that was Kirk's Penta. My exact comment is, how do we catch these with this measure? Because we want to make sure, we're saying we want to catch the CTs ordered for PE, but I think some of the CTs now are exactly being ordered for chest pain above the diaphragm, you know, chest pain between the chin and the diaphragm, and we want to, I think we do want to catch those, but how do we prove that the rec was ordered for PE and not?
Well, I would, this is Scott Gazelle, I would assume that they're going to catch them by CPT coding for the CTPA study, so that it wouldn't matter why it was ordered, it just matters that it was done without a positive D-dimer.
The medical record. This is Mike Backus. The medical record usually doesn't carry the coding, does it? Usually that gets put on billing later. If we're going to go back and do a chart extract.
And this is Richard Griffey. If you're getting a triple rule out, but your indication is rule out dissection.
They need to be a little bit more clear, I think, about how they'll capture the numerator event.
Don Rucker, I think for the triple rule out stuff, I think you ought to, I mean, I really see that as a separate measure. You know, it's rapidly evolving technology. I think it's just a separate deal than the sort of the PE. You know, those people come with a different history, fundamentally, I think, than those triple rule out patients come. I would just have that as a separate measure. I don't think I would try to glom this onto that in any way, shape, manner, or form.
Keith Campbell, I think it may be a little bit early to do that, but I think that Howie's point is very good, and I think you need to look down the pipe, because I can see this now, it's just the CTPA that's being used, but boy, I have chest pain, or I had chest pain 3 years ago, triple rule out.
What I understand, maybe some of you know better, some institutions, this is already a high volume study. Now, it's rare. It's rare institutions for now because the radiologists are not trained in the coronary imaging to this turf battle that's dividing them. But as people have already told me, oh, you'll be fine doing the coronary angiogram. I see this existing in most institutions using it as an
endpoint. So if my senses were saying that the so-called triple rule out should be excluded, we could just ask the measure developer to exclude that explicitly from the measure. Are you still with us?
I am, and I completely agree. I think they should be excluded. I think there's too many other things that come into play when deciding whether or not somebody needs a coronary CT angiogram, things like family history, smoking, other factors that we just can't exclude and include in this measure. So we'll definitely add on an exclusion for the triple rule out. I do, however, completely agree in that it's going to be a big deal, and it's ramping up, and there's definitely some quality measure that needs to be developed for it.
Hey, Rebecca.
Rebecca Smith-Bynum. I had a quick question just about what Don mentioned. Of the distribution of the indications for the low-prob PEs, how many have a positive D-dimer, and is that sort of close enough to what you guys have developed this for that you could, you know, understand the risk of that group, how it compares to the intermediate versus low-risk group?
I'm sorry. So let me just make sure I understand the question correctly.
Low clinical probability,
mm-hmm.
low positive D-dimers versus low probability negative high sensitivity D-dimers. What's the difference in prevalence of PEs in those two groups?
So I unfortunately don't have the data from the studies on me right this second, but there's actually enough of a difference that that have been adopted by international guidelines.
So the positive is high enough that it's equivalent to the intermediate or close to that group?
Exactly.
Right.
And they're both high enough that they need to be scanned.
Right.
Yeah. Rick Gibbons, as we discussed this triple rule out issue, I want to second the point that Howie made. There is some publicized insurance industry data from the Chicago area that shows that this is now a dominant theme in terms of testing in the ED. And I just want to express a concern that if we ask the measure developers to take that out of the numerator, the potential unintended consequence here will be to increase triple rule-out ordering, because that becomes the acceptable now non-measured alternative rather than CTPA. And I say that because of seeing patients who have presented the same way to the ED and gotten one study on one occasion, the triple rule out on another, and it's the same patient with the same presentation. So we may theoretically think, and I agree with the comment over the phone, that there are different issues that come into play, but in the real world, not necessarily the case.
Well, it seems to me that the easier unintended consequence or easier way out is just to say intermediate clinical probability by implicit clinical judgment, right? Because we don't require a structured evaluation. So if I really want to order a CT PA gram on somebody, I just say, I really think they are at intermediate clinical probability, and then they're not counted. So that to me is the bigger. That's my concern about this measure, is not requiring Wells or Geneva.
It costs a lot more radiation.
Troy and then Mike.
When the triple screens order, is there a CPT code for the CT?
No.
Is it a separate
three?
No.
It gets all
three.
Three
CTs.
Right. Sorry, I'm saying
the
wrong thing. When it's billed, it's three CTs.
You bill for all three.
And CTS doesn't even discount as far as
little contiguous body part.
It does discount.
Meaning when you do a search of CPT codes, would you pick up the CT pulmonary angiogram CPT code, or would you not pick it up?
No, you do all three CPT codes.
Okay. I mean, you still would tease out they're doing a CT pulmonary angiogram. If they did it for chest pain, but they didn't think they had a PE, that still is overuse. You still would pick it up in the numerator with the same search approach. It would get thrown in there. It may not be a bad thing.
But at that point, you'd have to do it retrospectively after the CPT codes had already put in rather than at the point of the ordering, which is what we're suggesting.
Can't tell them apart.
Okay.
Why the CT angiography was done, but it was done for PE, CT angiography. There are some differences.
Well, okay. One point of clarification for the measure developer. Were you planning to identify the exams, that is, the fact that a CT PA gram was done, by a search of the billing records, the claims, the CPT codes, or from a search of the medical records and the charts?
We were actually suggesting. That's a very valid point. We were actually suggesting, I think, at some point CPT code. So I apologize. I just misspoke. You're right. We would have to go back and do this retrospectively. So you're right. In a triple contrast scan, we would actually pick up the CPT code. I'm just reviewing the documentation now.
I'm sorry, Kirk Spencer. So that's what I was trying to point. So those, they are implicit included, unless you're going to say on medical chart review, it looked like that was also ordered with these other two, so we are going to take them out. Is that how you want to do it?
So if we do them with the CPT codes and review them, you're absolutely right, they will be included. And then if we look for, what we would have to actually do then is actually look for, in order to exclude them, we would have to look for the other two scans to make sure they were triple rule-out scans. And then exclude.
Right, but I'm still proposing that they stay in because the PE portion of the, whether they did the other two or not, if the PE test was in order for not a good indication for suspicion of PE,
right.
That's a very good point.
In our hospital, we also are getting a lot of pressure from the radiologists saying, look, no, these are very different studies. We, you know, pick. I'm gonna protocol it differently between the three, and, which is appropriate. I mean, I don't know how much true triple stuff is going on. We often, you know, they'll do one and we'll go back and look at it and say, hey, can you take a quick look at the other structure? But if people really are ordering, I would propose it because they did, or they ordered, apparently a PE gram without a good reason for a PE gram, they be included.
Yeah, that's true.
We could leave it in.
Leave it in. So then the other question I have for you as measure developer, how are you going to determine the level of clinical probability present at the time, that the especially when it can be an implicit judgment?
Right, and so that is going to require specific documentation, just like with other quality measures. That's going to require specific documentation by the physician. Either they would have to include the criteria for the Wells or the Geneva, or their implicit clinical judgment, or they would simply have to say, via Wells criteria, they were intermediate probability, and so I obtained a D-dimer, or I did not obtain a D-dimer and scanned them.
So this gets into the discussion we had yesterday. If you have an order entry system, it's easy to capture that for the measure. If you don't have an order entry system for a site to participate in this measure, you would have to do what, manual chart reviews?
You would have to do manual chart reviews, and the physicians would have to know that whenever I order a scan for a pulmonary embolus, I need to document what my clinical indications are, which is really something they should be doing anyway.
All right. Other questions or comments? Judy.
Judy Zerzan. I think that all of this discussion, you mentioned gaps before, that this is a huge gap. Something certainly on the horizon as people are scanning and going crazy. So I just want to explicitly say we need this as payers. Thanks.
I actually already wrote down that clearly there's some recommendations.
Okay. All right. Should we vote? Okay. Let's go ahead. Yes, it's with conditions. The conditions are that we've entirely modified this. This with the consent of the developer to become an overuse measure, where the denominator is unchanged, the numerator is now the low clinical probability and either no high sensitivity D dimer or a negative high sensitivity D dimer. So we are ready to vote. Yes.
Before we do
please,
open up the vote, we'd like to see if anyone's on the line or any public comment from here in the room.
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So we're voting on the importance characteristic or importance score. How many people would give it a high? Got a number? How many people would like to give it a middle? One. And how many people would like to give it a low? One. Okay. So that should mean we have 18 people in the room. We'll keep an eye on that for the next vote. All right, for the second category, we're okay? For the scientific acceptance.
Sorry, I just was trying to figure out. How many
did
we actually have?
18,
that's right.
Okay. We lost Mary's, and
we had 19 yesterday.
We had 20.
There's 19 in the room right now.
Okay, let's vote again.
Just vote the medium.
I think there was a second medium.
Was there a second medium?
It's got to be high because there's only one.
I thought there were two people for a middle.
Okay, how many for middle again? And how many for low? Okay, so there you go.
Perfect.
Almost tempting to change one of the middle of them.
Okay, for scientific acceptability of the measure, how many people have high?
Yeah.
Okay. How many people have middle? And that should be no lows. Any lows?
Okay, we total 20.
For usability?
Totals off.
Oh, that's 20. All right, let's vote the highs again.
We did this.
Oh, it was. How?
Everybody that voted absentee yesterday and voted against it.
And just so you know, so this meeting is finally convinced us we're about to order those little
handhelds.
All right, for usability, how many highs?
Zero.
How many mediums? And how many lows? All right. And for feasibility, high? No highs. Medium? And low. Okay, now we're voting to either recommend for endorsement or not recommend for endorsement. Who would like to vote to recommend for endorsement with the conditions as stated? And time limited. And who would like to vote against recommending for endorsement? All right. So we can move on now to measure number 6, which is appropriate head CT imaging in adults with acute traumatic headache. Who is the primary reviewer of this one? Is that Judy? Which is the number 13? No, we were going to discuss 8 next because of Howie, but we could do 8 first, I suppose, and then do 6 and 13, if you'd like. Why don't we do 8? So we will do 8 next, which is a appropriate cervical spine CT imaging in trauma. Howie, you're the primary reviewer?
Either of
them. Okay, so start, please, by just summarizing the measure and stating the numerator and denominator.
Okay, so this is very similar in some ways to our CT imaging of the head in the setting of trauma. The numerator is appropriate use of using the evidence-based guideline or using the tested rule, and there are 2 tested rules, but the one that they're using here. And the denominator is all patients that are presenting with neck trauma. I just want to make sure I'm not saying that right. I know.
Number eight.
Just to point out for the moment, it's very similar to yesterday. The one big distinction is a lot of the evidence for which this is based on radiography. On originally radiography as opposed to based on CT use. but this has been, again, a long-standing measure, and CT of the cervical spine has been available, just not nearly as broadly used, for over 20, 25 years in the setting of trauma. The it's really important, actually, the trauma. The other important thing to mention about this, just to keep in the back of your mind as we work through this, is that in the sense of the unintended consequences, this may actually increase the use of CT imaging of the cervical spine, because a lot of patients that would fit the criteria for appropriate use of CT of the cervical spine are appropriately imaged with cervical spine radiography right now. Well, I realize it has nothing to do with the purview of this group. I would just point out that from a cost standpoint, from a real cost standpoint, CT cervical spine imaging is cheaper than CT radiography, primarily because only probably less than 5% of all patients that are going to get a cervical spine CT are not getting a head CT already. So I'm talking true cost. I'm not talking a societal cost. I'm not talking Medicare cost. I'm talking, and this is something that the payers can think about at another time. But the true cost of doing this is the minimum. The patient is on the table. The extra time for the scanning is about 30 seconds. So the true cost of doing this is the minimum. So from a real economic perspective, if the unintended consequence occurs, it's not a bad thing. The radiation risk is no different. The technical feasibility of doing it is actually easier. Cervical spine radiography is more difficult to interpret, even if it is compensated less. So on every economic count, I would say that we shouldn't worry about that, but from a on the ground, what would it mean for payers? It could be a problem for the beginning. Sorry.
Well, but from a payer point of view, if the technologies are used together 75% of the time, they're going to be bundled soon enough anyway.
I would hope so.
Exceptionally clear bundling is.
Okay.
The interpretation is going to be bundled?
They're not bundled.
They're separate.
No interpretation.
Right. So the cost, this is Rebecca Smith-Fine, and the cost in terms of paying a radiologist to read a CT is not comparable to reading a cervical spine plane film.
For no good reason, but I agree.
For no good reason, but that's a huge, difference.
So,
I'll be at
MedPAC
on next Tuesday, so I'll...
So let's go through the full summary of the measure first, and then we'll have a discussion, if we could.
Anyway, getting back to that, so that's the main caveat. Everything else that we're talking about, the evidence here is very comparable to the head CT, so I'm just going to run through this and hopefully do it a little more efficiently than yesterday. So starting on importance to measure and report, I believe meets completely in terms of the mere magnitude. The magnitude that Dave indicated, and I can tell you from experience that the use has only gone up in the last few years and considerably. So there's considerable amounts of evidence supporting that. The opportunity to improvement 1B, I also believe, is completely met in the sense that there are clear benefits and there's comparable data of the head CT that there are a good number of cervical spine radiographs and CTs that are currently being done that are inappropriate and that could be excluded. On outcome or evidence support measure focus, I think that there's, as pointed out, there are the two large studies, the Canadian study and the beginning of New Orleans or Nexus criteria, both of which have been validated, both of which have found to be considerably sensitive and specific, relatively speaking, with the Canadian one being more sensitive than the Nexus criteria and more specific according to this, but again, applied in radiography. The rating and the strength, the quality of the evidence is strong, and the only real controversial issue is this issue of radiography versus computed tomography. And so was the threshold criterion important to measure and report met? I would say yes. Scientific acceptability and measure properties. We talked about the how it's structured and what the rules actually are. There's just one, somewhere in here, there's one typo where it talks about five criteria, I think it's four.
is for, but other than that, everything...
On page 4.
Thank you. Yeah, on page 4, it just mentions the 1.5 criteria patients are required to meet. It should read the 4. That's not critical. So again, measure specifications, I think, meet completely for one category, not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Measure properties. And then under testing analysis, reliability testing, it's partially met only because it really needs, we really don't have the CT studies, we have the radiography studies. So that's why I'm looking at it partially met. Exclusions justified primarily on the basis that they hadn't been tested populations, and primarily excluding children under 16, and I think there were pregnant women and others in that category as well, and over 65, I think. And so overall, to what extent was the criterion of scientific accessibility of measure properties met? Do you completely...
Scott here, interrupt this. The question of testing is not testing of the criteria, it's testing of this measure. And this measure is a composite of all the different criteria with CT, so I would say it hasn't been tested at all, if I'm interpreting the grading scale.
It's only ultra-performance.
Right.
Okay. And then under, so I guess under scientific accessibility, then we go back to partially met under that, okay. Then on the usability, I think this is the, in the absence of having had testing and knowing the exact same problems that we've discussed with other measures where we're required to either parse from the chart or use to utilize position or entry and so on, we come back to the same basic issue. But here, I would say, minimally met. So there is an existing measure with NQF, which is the cervical spine radiography measure. So the measures are not harmonized now; it would be harmonized after testing, I presume.
They're not harmonized now.
Well,
it wouldn't be harmonized after testing. Could you elaborate on why they're not?
He wrote that they're not harmonized, and I accepted that as on page. Okay, so the distinctive or added value, I think, it really does considerably update where we actually are compared to where we were in terms of imaging in the emergency room. And I do think for anyone that has experienced it, you see that the economics haven't yet shifted appropriately. Everybody is getting cervical spine imaging, if they're already getting a head CT, and there's no good prudent reason to not do it other than the financial concerns, because the radiation can be minimized, be less than the radiography, the speed of the and the risk is that you do the head CT, then you do the cervical spine imaging, it's inadequate, and you have to bring the patient back again. So there are real good clinical care reasons to want to do that. Then under feasibility, again, getting back to the issue of how you would be able to capture the measure, you'd be able to capture the data in order to provide data at a center or individual physician basis, partially met or minimally met, depending on how you look at it. I think that's the biggest hurdle once again. I do think, much like the cervical spine, much like the head CT issue, the individual sheet, can be filled out, and I do agree that even if people are going to figure out how to game the system, so to speak, by choosing certain categories, it's going to force them to have to choose a category nonetheless, presumably that, most people are going to actually be honest. So hopefully it will actually have the effect of deterring some use, and I think there is excessive use out there. So overall, I would,
all right, Jacqueline.
Yes, Jacqueline Bello. I'm the second reviewer, and I just wanted to make a few additional comments. First, to note that on page 3, under 1B, opportunity for improvement,
studies have shown that a decrease in cervical spine imaging of up to, and we're left without the curl there, how much it might be reduced from that.
So can we pause for a second to make sure the developer is aware of what we're talking about here?
I am, and I'm actually pulling up that data right now. I will have that for you in just a few minutes.
That would need to be added, though, to the measure.
Absolutely, to 1B.
It'll come out in our discussion. If I just might continue. I had a somewhat different idea from Howie in terms of whether it would suddenly increase the number of CTs. And that's because, at least from the experience where we do a lot of trauma, and as I mentioned yesterday, a lot of head spine imaging, very few of the patients at our institution whose C spine is being evaluated aren't already getting, for trauma, aren't already getting a head CT. Now, the converse of that is not true. If you have absolute head-only trauma and you're happy, and you, that, then you just get a head plane. But the number that don't already get a head CT, and because they're already getting one, I'm of the impression that they're not getting their head CT and then going over to plane zone for the C spine. And so I really don't think it's going to increase the number of C spine CTs to that same possible extent. The only other point I wanted to add is that in addition to the two rules, the Canadian rule and the Nexus rule, there is this third track that you can take having to do with a range of motion. And I think that that muddies the water a little bit compared to yesterday's discussion where we had a combination of two rules. Just because there are too few people with the courage of my conviction who are going to jump in there and do these range of motion exams, I think. And I think it's in terms of the section that we have that says how translatable is the are the criteria, I think it's a little bit more muddy, and I would just maybe ask the developers to expand on that a little bit.
Thank you.
Other than that, I was in basic.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? Sure.
So,
Richard and
Richard Griffey, I agree with both the assessments of the measure. And, you know, the ACR recommendation for the appropriateness criteria is to CT these patients, which I think differs from our take in emergency medicine and in emergency radiology. And so I think it's not an inconsiderable concern that this could increase CT. I do agree with the authors that, look, if we're applying this standard to X-ray, we should at least apply some standard, this standard, to CT. There are two or three small papers, Blackmore and Hansen and some others, that have tried to apply some science to the decision step between identifying not just the very low risk who don't need X-rays and those group who are at higher risk who need primary CT instead of, you know, secondary CT instead of primary X-ray. But it, the science is not really fully fleshed out there yet. Those papers identify that if you're, and others identify that if you're getting a head CT already, the incremental issues with getting a CT to the C-spine, it just makes sense to do that. It's cost-effective and time-effective. But in other patients who don't, you know, who meet the criteria for some imaging, it would be a little concerning to if this is viewed as a rubber stamp. Okay, they need imaging, go on to CT, in my view. At the same time, we have to apply some standard, and so I think that it's imperfect, but it is what it is.
Thank you. Steve
Gamble, I have several concerns. First of all, this is a title. The title is Appropriate Cervical Spine Imaging in Adults with Trauma. And I refer you to the ordering sheet. What is the one study you can order? Cervical C-spine CT. This implies, by definition, that plain films of the neck are no longer adequate. So, in fact, at least in our practice, we have a significant number of patients with minor deceleration MVC with no loss of consciousness and no head trauma who comes in complaining of neck pain. Of course they're going to get their C-spine study. And they don't need a head CT. So if you get into the business, well, they're going for a neck, let's get a head. They're going for a head, let's get a neck. But we have a significant number that do not need their head done. So in fact, there would be an increase, at least in our practice, in terms of the number of CTs of the neck that would be done. And I am concerned that this becomes a de facto standard. And as Richard mentioned, based on really not a lot of data, we're not really not there yet. So, and I think that the cost is also an issue. The incremental cost of the technical cost, absolutely. And the electrons are cheap, and the time is not an issue. But it's the charge for the radiologist that, in fact, will be borne by society, as currently we have this our financing apparently structured. I am also concerned about the radiation exposure. Now, I can't speak with authority. How, in terms of plain films of the neck versus CT of the neck, what's the difference in terms of RADs?
Oh, I mean, I don't have a hard estimate right now. I would say that comparable, once you actually factor in the actual number of films that you're actually taking, you're taking typically 7 images, even though it's considered to be a 4 view, but you end up taking somewhere between 2 and 3 laterals. You take 1 AP, both of lights, and an AP open mouth and down toys. So once you get to that, dealing with a lot of images through a narrow area, and you're basically, the radiation is at least comparable. I would
higher
say reality is higher.
Okay. One other issue, we talk about efficiency standards, and I got to tell you, it's Saturday night in the ED, and I'm just up to my eyeballs and patients, and I'm trying to get necks cleared. You know, plain films, I can clear. C-spines, CT, that's the radiologist. And So I've got all these people laying around and hard collars on, and I talk to the radiologist. He says, well, you know, I've got 27 CTs I've got to read. So when we talk about efficiency, part of efficiency is throughput. In fact, I see this as in, not all the time, but in certain situations, in fact, it's going to decrease our overall departmental efficiency.
Patty Braxton, I just want to take a counterpoint to that. I had a question for Holly because we used to do plain radiographs on all of our trauma patients, and I can't tell you how many patients that had to make the trip to CT and you couldn't see 5671. And my life has been made easier by the use of CT with reconstruction. I can clear C-spines much more quickly.
Well, I'm not saying it's a bad study. I'm just saying.
So my question is, what percentage of patients do you think, I mean, I remember my own anecdotal experience, but what percentage of patients getting plain radiographs has inadequate visualization?
As high as 68%.
Yeah. Someone like me, it's
rare.
We're
not in the United States. 3 years, 10 films were higher. But when you count the number of needs and everything else.
Jacqueline
Bello, just on the point of interpretation, I would propose that given the reformatted images in the sagittal plane, if you can clear and patient on the basis of the C-spine radiograph, you can, if you're not ready to wait for the radiologist, clear on the basis of the reformatted images. I think that that's just a practical problem.
But remember, most of us don't have diagnostic foot quality monitors. The radiologist won't even have that.
Monitor
with
the
plain
film is a higher resolution.
Holding that ovary money here. Don.
Just on the record, I think that, you know, to Patty's point, Steve's point, you know, the other dynamic here, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how this interprets it, but seemingly many, if not most, of the plain film C-spines we get, there's a hedge on the report that says, if you're really worried about this, please get a CT scan, right? You know, so the... We as ER docs are left with these little time bombs. Thank you. I'm sure how you don't do it, but you know.
That's only the private sector, though.
Yeah, right. Well, the places where I work have not been, you know, major university kind of hospitals, and that is the norm to get those kind of to get those hedge kind of things. If you're really concerned,
get a real test.
Get a real test. So this measure, I think, you know, in terms of where it has to be targeted, I think it's in many ways not entirely clear to me. You know, is it sort of more of an ER, or is it more of a radiology? If you're putting that boilerplate on your reports, or your house staff are putting that boilerplate on your reports, that's a problem.
Kirk. Kirk Spencer. Can I back up a second? Is the measure to, I'm trying to understand, decrease the number of people who don't need any imaging of their spine, in which case x-rays and CTs should be together, or is it to decrease the number of people that get CTs instead of C-spine? What's the heart here?
I think my sense is it's not a comparative CT versus plain film. It's just a measure that the people who are getting CT of the C-spine are getting it appropriately. That's how it's intended.
Right.
That's why it needs to be harmonized as well. It needs to be measured as applicable. This is how we again, as applicable to the CT cervical spine as it is to plain radiography. The only reason we're talking about the comparative issue, I think, is because I raised the concern about the unintended consequence, which I personally don't think, from a true economic point of view, as opposed to from a financial payer point of view, is a concern.
Again, I'm sorry, I still don't understand. Are we trying to not image the C-spine of people who don't have a clinical indication? Is that what
not,
we're trying
not,
to do?
Not do overall. CT. This measure is only about CT.
All right, then why is it a use? Okay.
Because we already have a measure about C-spine.
Richard.
Oh, that's
yeah,
the one
there's already
before.
One.
My recommendation is,
okay, gotcha. I'm sorry.
If there's already a measure about C-spine, then why don't we change the measure, recommend changing that measure to imaging?
Right.
Then
that's
you
what
cover any modality. And
the goal,
achieve the effect.
Shouldn't we be imaging?
Yeah.
In any way.
Right. And just to remind people, the prior measure was actually from Harvard Medical Center. Yeah. And it was the percentage of patients undergoing cervical spine radiographic trauma who do not have neck pain, dysphoria, pain, neurologic deficits, reduced level of consciousness, or intoxication. It's really the same.
Right. So, I mean, if there were another measure that was, I don't really understand exactly what harmonization is. But if there were a measure that allowed for I like Nexus or CCR, I like offering making those different options available, the Canadian C spine, which also I believe includes the range of motion. So I think that's where that comes in.
Right.
That if you made those sort of the standard for any image, any modality.
Although, just let's be clear, we're not including MR in this.
Or
no.
Ultrasound.
Why not MR?
If I could, Steve Gandrow, if I could just get the worst gap, my suggestion would be to change the title appropriate CT cervical spine imaging. But Rich's suggestion, I think, really solves the much bigger issue. If we just call it imaging, cervical spine imaging, you can do whatever you want. If you want to do plain films, you can do plain films. If you want to do CT, you can do CT. But we're saying no matter what you do, you got to have an indication.
Right. But that's for when, excuse Kirk Spencer, from the neuro people, are there indications to do one or the other in trauma? Right there.
Not in these patients.
In this group of patients. Okay.
I mean, it's clinical.
Sure. I mean, if you have, like, a hard neurologic injury, then it's going to be an indication for an MRI. I mean, is that what you're asking?
No. We're leaving an MRI out.
This is
trauma. Between radiography.
Between primary CT and primary X-ray, the Harvard Review group is sort of at the lead, and that,
yeah.
Like I said, the science is really
there. Jacqueline, and then Roger.
Jacqueline Bella. So the one time that there would be an indication for one instead of the other is if it's clear that this patient is going to the OR to be instrumented, the surgeon wants the CT.
But I wouldn't put that in this level.
I'm not putting it in here.
Yeah.
I'm answering the question,
yeah.
Is there in the world of neuroradiology when one is indicated over here?
Yeah. Thank you. Roger?
Just a comment. I think this is an example of a situation in which our historical practice of telling the radiologist what to do is a great mistake. And we should just be telling them what the problem is. We say, we need imaging of the C-spine, and then let the radiologist figure out what's the best way to do it. It should be bundled and paid that way. And this is an example, and there are many others.
It's a great payer idea.
Okay.
Patty Radcliffe, Jacqueline's defending my brethren, but, I mean, this is one case where, you know, a neurosurgeon may, in fact, need a CT scan and an MRI and an angiogram before going to the operating room with the patient.
My comment incorporates that thinking. It's the same.
But the radiologist is not going to tell us what the appropriate study is. Or how do I know I don't need a myelogram before going?
All right, well, that's sort of outside of this measure. So I had a couple concerns about the measure. One is I had to read the numerator details about 10 times before I could understand the cascading OR statement, particularly 2A.3.2B. And maybe it's simpler to people who do ED imaging, but none of the following risk factors that allow safe assessment of range of motion.
Especially just sitting in the ER.
Patient found sitting in the emergency department. I mean, at some level, everybody is found sitting.
So
my question, I have a concern on two levels. One is these things are not really clearly defined. You know, what is delayed onset of neck pain? What does it mean to be found sitting in the emergency department? And moreover, I think it's going to be very difficult to determine that they exist or don't exist, all of them, from a medical record review. And so I think that's a real problem with this measure, personally.
It would require a separate sheet, just like the other measures that we've discussed. You know,
And definitions for all of these sort of vague things. So I'm concerned about that aspect of the feasibility of the measure based on that specific.
If I may interrupt just a second on that. So you bring up a good point. You're talking about two different things. Number one, the feasibility of collection of data, which I agree is going to require a separate form. But number two, as far as the standardization of these criteria, so they're all part of the Canadian cervical spine rules, which have been used now for about 8 years or 9 years. And just in October of 2009, the Canadians published a article in BMJ in which they actually used these rules in 12 centers in Britain, and actually found that they were not just feasible, but they actually reduced imaging overuse. And this was by a wide variety of emergency physicians and PAs and trainees, and found that even though the criteria are somewhat vague, they're actually able to be used by a wide variety of people, including actually now they've recently done a study with paramedics actually that have found that they can actually use the rule as well. So I agree that they seem vague, but they've been used and it's been proven that they're feasible.
That's not what my point was. My point is not about the nexus of the Canadian C-spine rules. My point is about your 2A.3.2B.
No, sir, those are actually part of the Canadian
C-spine. I understand that. And so if you'd let me finish, what I'm trying to say is, since it's already part of the Canadian C-spine rules, why does it need to be in this measure separately specified?
You just specify Canadian C-spine rules without all.
They already are in the two ORs above.
You're right. They don't need to. If we can simply say Canadian cervical spine rule, then that's fine.
Yeah, because that's the first of the second of the cascading OR statements, and then it's followed by a restatement of part of the Canadian C-spine rule. And so if you just take that last one out, it clarifies the measure.
Absolutely.
Steve Gander, I have a question. What would be involved, and since we already have the previous NQF proposal in terms of limiting for plain films, and now we have one for CT, how do we go about merging these together? I mean, just what is, mechanistically, what do we have to do here? Because I think it's really simple, and it's an extension of really the one that was passed in 2008.
Yeah, I agree. I think the simplest approach would be, and we can talk to the folks offline at the Brigham, but I think the simplest approach would be a sort of approach the Harvard View folks, have them talk to these folks, see if they come up with a measure that actually reflects cervical spine images broadly. I think that's the simplest approach. And we can table that discussion until a follow-up conference call so that it can get sorted out.
So should we then not vote on this?
But you, I don't know that. I think it's fine to defer that until you have more information.
Vote to harmonize.
Yeah, it's not a vote.
Should we just take a sort of a straw poll to see that everyone is in favor of that approach?
Yeah.
Who is there everyone in favor of that approach that is taking it offline, trying to harmonize?
Neutral way to ask.
All right, anyone opposed?
Sounds like a
box.
I'm sorry.
Greatest president ever or evil devil?
Collaboration, harmonization.
Okay, so now we are moving on to, let's see, that was just number 8, and we're, so we decided to go to 6 and then 13 is the order we're going to do. And I don't know what we're doing in terms of scheduled. Do we need a brief break, or should we push through and let people who need a break for food or other things go on? Okay. All right. So we're going on to number 6, which is appropriate head CT imaging in adults with acute atraumatic headache. That is from. That's the review group 3. Who's going to take the lead on describing the measure?
The three of us discussed both of these measures, but I will, Patty Rex, and I will present measure number 6, which is entitled Appropriate CT Imaging in Adults with Acute Atraumatic Headache. The numerator in this case is the number of denominator patients who have an American College Emergency Physician's Indication for Head CT. And the denominator is the number of patients with acute headaches who are undergoing CT to meet their inclusion criteria. We'll move through here. In terms of 1A, we believe that it's just met completely the criteria. We believe this is an important area of research. However, they said that their primary aim was to specify appropriate criteria, and that's not what this measure is actually set up to measure. This will simply identify individuals who meet existing criteria outlined in a single guideline effort. In terms of 1B, opportunities for improvement, as the group pointed out, using the Goldstein study, 98% of patients were determined to have a benign cause for their headache. 14% of those patients were imaged, and about 5% eventually had what they called a pathological diagnosis. They also pointed out that utilization has varied widely, even within their one medical center, from 5.8% to 11.5%. We did, however, ask the developers this question. They called this acute headache, but then defined that as less than 14 days, and I think our neurologists here would take exception to that, really talking about subacute if they're going to stretch it out to 14 days of symptoms. For 1B, we gave them a partial for those reasons. Things start to get a little bit hairier when we get to 1C, the outcome or evidence to support the measure focus. We haven't actually talked so much about this, but when we're developing these measures for consideration, I think that the strength of the evidence that's being used as a basis for that measure is quite important. And this is a case where the evidence base is not very strong. Their entire measure is based on the American College of Emergency Physicians guideline, which was really a consensus statement. And as they themselves cited, they're using class 2 evidence to make a level 3 recommendation, and they have their own internal system. So I'll tell you, level C in their system is consensus recommendations based on incomplete, conflicting, or preliminary evidence. Right, this is the point. So,
yeah. Should we?
I have a little bit of a problem in using that evidence.
So we should pause and have a discussion of the importance, because if it fails there, we don't need to go on.
Because
the evidence
focus
is required to pass number 1.
Right.
Actually, we have many level B recommendations here. They're not all levels.
Right.
In terms of patients presenting to ED with headache, a new abnormal findings, and a neurologic examination, and then patients presenting with new sudden onset severe headache, and then HIV-positive patients. Those are all level B recommendations.
Well, in the body of this proposed measure, and if you go back to the document, I agree with you, part of it is listed as a level B recommendation, but and they have made an internal mistake in the body of this document.
I have the document. I have
the document as well.
I've got it right here. I've read you from the Level B recommendation.
I understand that, but it's the entire way in which they've gone about generating the recommendations that were made in that document that is the problem here. It really is nothing more than a consensus statement.
So what I would propose then is we should hear from the other members of the review committee, unless you're all agreeing. So then we could have a brief discussion and vote on importance. And then if we agree that it's important, we'll continue on, but this will simplify our. Are there other thoughts on the importance?
So the three primary reviewers, it's your view that it doesn't meet the – essentially the clinical standard?
I disagree. Okay. Level B recommendations are based on strength of evidence of class 2 studies that directly address the issue. That's reading from the definition of Level B recommendations. What I read you before were Level B recommendations. So I am confused about how we're saying these are consensus recommendations.
Judy?
This is Judy Vision, and so they say that they're Level C, and they include everything. If they had perhaps picked out the things that there was better evidence for, then you could say it. But as this stands, covering the whole spectrum of headache, I think it's inadequate. It also, they state at the end in their rationale for using this guideline, is that it's the most recent literature review published up to August 2006. And so in my mind, that's old, and I don't know if there's other studies that support that, but I thought that this is primarily based on expert opinion, and that's a very low level of evidence.
Do the authors have any comment about that?
You've all brought up very good points, and if it says 2006, I apologize. That must have been a typo. The ASF clinical policy came out in October of 2008. You're both right in that a lot of this is Level B evidence, but there is some data behind it. We have Class 2 studies that have actually recommended the majority of these points. You're right in that we should have excluded some of the Level C stuff, but rather than make an individual decision on our point, we deferred to the guideline of this national body that underwent a whole lot more review than the four of us or the two of us could actually do. So we kept their guideline as a whole. If you think that it might be more acceptable if it simply came back as just the Level B recommendations, we're happy to do that as well.
I think that's more than a Helen. That would be more than a revision, right? I think because that would require discussion of the whole committee. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable
It's just not clear from reading it at this point what then
what's
and what
that.
I don't think you have enough information to know how significant a change that is.
So,
which elements of the guideline are B versus C.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have a
difference.
Well, we have to go through
and
actually line them up.
So why don't we...
And actually, the next one that we do about this that's prepared by CMS, I think, does a very nice job of outlining all of the different guidelines about imaging and headache that was much more thorough and complete when compared to this one.
So why don't we, as...
There's
also
guidelines out there, the Headache Consortium, American Academy of Neurology. I would like to have seen the ASAP in this article. They did reach out to specific neurologists without naming them and headache specialists, but there was no consensus. There was no support. I'm not sure what recommendations were included in their guidelines. So I would have liked to see this. This is a gray area, although it's an emergency room issue. But as you know, headache and neurology. So I'd like to see a consensus on multiple groups before and change the guidelines accordingly. Because those guidelines that were recommended are a little bit, a tad different than the guidelines that the American Headache Society has supported.
So unless there are any more comments in favor of this, should we just vote to recommend or not, on the importance issue? Yeah. So, okay. On the importance criterion, how many people in the room would like to give it a high? Okay, zero. How many people would like to give it a middle? Looks like three. And how many people would like to give it a low? the remainder. So that should be 16. Okay.
No vote.
All right. 15 and one abstention. All right, so we can move on to the next measure, which is, let's do measure, should we do measure 13? 13, same topic? Okay, measure 13, who is going to be the discussant for 13?
This is Judy Zerzan, and we all discussed this. So the summary of this measure is it's developed by CMS.